Thank you, Jonga Kandemiri, and good evening, Zimbabwe. You're listening to Studio 7 from The Voice of America on Thursday, March 24th, 2016. Thank you for joining us this evening live from Washington. I am Dimyake Mwakalielie. Here are our top stories this evening. Some landless white commercial farmers express skepticism over Zimbabwe's move to compensate them for seized land.
Where is the money going to come from to pay for this compensation?
There is solutions, but they have to sit down around a table and sort this problem out because the money is not going to grow from the ground.
60 young Zimbabweans have been selected for the prestigious Mandela Washington Fellowship Program. A Zimbabwean human rights activist says there is need for the rehabilitation and compensation of victims of political violence.
Some people lost their property. They have to be compensated because their homes were destroyed. And then we go to rehabilitation. They must be rehabilitated again.
And Zimbabwe joined the other nations around the world today in commemorating World TB Day. So stick around for these stories and much more coming up. Stay tuned. Sixty young Zimbabweans have been selected for the 2016 Mandela Washington Fellowship Program, a brainchild of United States President Barack Obama. In a statement, the United States Embassy in Harare said there are 31 male and 29 female participants from Zimbabwe this year. Zimbabwe has over the years provided at least 30 fellows per year, but the number has since doubled following a nod from President Obama to increase the number of participants in all nations. The Mandela Washington Fellowship is the flagship program of Mr. Obama's signature Young African Leaders Initiative, launched in 2010 to deepen the United States' engagement with the youth of Africa. So far, more than 100 young Zimbabweans have participated in the program. Every year on March 24th, millions of people around the world join the United Nations in commemorating International Day for the Right to the Truth concerning gross human rights violations and for the dignity of victims. This day honors victims of human rights violations and promotes the importance of the right to truth and justice. This is also a time to pay tribute to people who have devoted their lives to and lost their lives in the struggle to promote and protect human rights for all. Alois Mutanga, director of the Association of the Victims of Political Violence, tells Studio 7's Chioneso Jani that rehabilitation and compensation is needed for victims of political violence.
The president and ZANU-PF are the people who were sending the army and the police to come and victimize us from the year 2000 up to 2008. See, you will see that 2007 and 2008, they offer intimidation. These are the gross human rights abuses were at their height, 2007 and 2008. And many people were victimized. The people were victimized, more than 3 million people were victimized here at this time.
As an organization, what does this day represent to you and what are you advocating for?
Some aspect that we advocate for now. One is that I talked about the registration of the victims and documentation of the victims. One. Two, the compensation. Some people lost their property. They have to be compensated because their homes were destroyed. And then we go to rehabilitation. They must be rehabilitated again. Some were chased by the chiefs, the headmen, from their places because they were supporting the opposition. They were chased away. We advocate that these people must be returned to their places, and then this discrimination must end, because there is still this discrimination, this victimization is still there in the rural areas, particularly in the rural areas. It is still there. Compensation is such. Because if you look at a victim for the last 15 or 16 years, we have not been receiving any aid from the government in the form of fertilizers, in the form of food, in the form of food aid. These victims are not receiving all this aid from the government. If you look at what is the situation there in Zimbabwe, definitely it's hard for the victim now. For the last 15 years, they've not been receiving fertilizer, and the government was the only supplier of fertilizer and maize seed. But no one has been receiving this thing. There is no work. There are no jobs there in Zimbabwe. You see, that's our plight. We are struggling. We are starving. It's the government that is making us all these things. So every victim must receive this money for every month.
That was Alois Mutanga, director of the Association of the Victims of Political Violence, speaking with Studio 7's Chioneso Jani from Johannesburg, South Africa. Efforts to get a comment from presidential spokesperson George Charamba were in vain as his phone was not reachable. President Robert Mugabe yesterday left Zimbabwe for Tokyo, Japan on a five-day official visit. According to the state-controlled Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, Mr. Mugabe was invited by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The visit comes a few weeks after President Mugabe dropped a trip to India to attend a cultural event, which was snubbed by the host president and other heads of state and government. Zimbabwe joined other nations today in commemorating World TB Day. According to the Herald newspaper, the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease says it has spent about $18 million in the past 5 years to support TB programs in Zimbabwe. Other organizations engaged in tackling TB in the nation include the United Nations Development Program and the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria. Tuberculosis is a deadly and infectious bacterial disease that kills millions of people annually. And health organizations are using this year's commemorations to call on everyone to unite to end TB. Algerian-based Zimbabwean junior doctor Chipo Chatukuta tells Studio 7's Chioneso Jani that not much is known about the deadly nature of TB compared to HIV/AIDS.
Tuberculosis diagnosis under the National TB Program in Zimbabwe. The treatment services are integrated with general health services at the health facilities of the country. When patients present with TB, when they have these coughs, the night sweats, the weight loss, these are recorded in the TB suspect register and they have their sputum examined. It's important to be sure that a patient has got tuberculosis before we put them on treatment. Because if the person does not have tuberculosis, they might resist the drug after a certain time when they actually do have tuberculosis.
This year, the theme is Unite to End TB. How can organizations come together with the communities or implement health work policies to end TB?
The biggest challenge we have currently is that most patients do not finish their treatment course. The treatment course varies, but usually the basic first-line treatment is a six-month treatment. Now, most patients would take the treatment for the first few weeks or months. As soon as they feel better, they abandon that treatment, which in turn causes drug resistance. Now, how can communities and the government in general help in ending this pandemic we have of tuberculosis? Well, firstly, coming down to the grassroots level, when patients are traced in a community by a village health worker, for example, these patients should be referred to the nearest health facility. And this is by educating them on the importance of them being treated, of the family being screened to see if there's any further spread. If we have the media reaching out to these organizations in order for them to be able to spread the message far and wide, that would help curb and indeed fight and end the spread of tuberculosis.
Can someone have TB without having HIV?
The two diseases are not always related. A person can have TB without having HIV. So you being exposed to this tuberculosis-infected person can put you at risk for getting it. The only difference is that HIV-positive patients have got a higher risk of catching it because of their decreased immunity.
That was Dr. Chipo Chatukuta, a Zimbabwean junior doctor based in Algeria, and she spoke with Studio 7's Chioneso Jani. Chioneso Jani also spoke with a TB patient, 53-year-old Annie Chitamba, who described the experience of having TB as painful and said that she also found it embarrassing to explain to people her condition. Some former white commercial farmers who lost their land under Zimbabwe's controversial agrarian reforms introduced in 2000 have welcomed moves by the government to compensate them for their farms, which were seized by the state. However, several displaced farmers remain skeptical about the government's sincerity over the issue. Our correspondent Arthur Chigoriwa interviewed some of them and filed this report.
Some evicted white farmers relocated to urban areas while others resettled in Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, Nigeria and Britain, among several other nations. They ventured into commercial farming and are said to be doing well in these countries. Zimbabwe refused to compensate them after forcibly taking over their land. At least several farmers decided to take the matter to local and regional courts. They ended up being granted an order in South Africa to auction property belonging to the Zimbabwean government in an attempt to get some form of compensation. The recent announcement by President Robert Mugabe's government that it intends to compensate the farmers for the seized land has been received mostly with skepticism by some of the farmers. They say Zimbabwean leaders lack the political will to settle such matters and the capacity to mobilize financial resources to fund the exercise due to the depressed economy, widely projected to grow by only 1.5% this year. Independent evaluators estimated that Zimbabwe needs to pay the farmers $8.6 billion for seized assets such as houses and about $2.8 billion for the land. The ruling party leadership has vowed that Zimbabwe will never compensate farmers for the land. Former white commercial farmer John Rodriguez, who ventured into wildlife management after losing his land, says the government is too broke to pay any kind of compensation to the evicted farmers.
Where is the money going to come from to pay for this compensation? There is solutions, but they have to sit down around the table and sort this problem out, because the money is not going to grow from the ground. It's not, and nobody's going to help. So we've got problems. And these promises, if they keep it, well, truly, it's going to benefit everybody. But I can't see it happening. We can talk. We can keep on talking for years, but nothing is going to be solved. Where is the property rights? Where is the lease agreements as approved on an international standard? I can't see it.
Another former commercial farmer, Kerry Kay, believes that the government's move is an acknowledgement that the land reform scheme was disastrous.
I would like to believe that they are being sincere. I really would, because I think they've understood now that you know, from being the breadbasket, we now are a basket case. And it's, I mean, we're blessed with the most incredible country and the most incredible people.
Hendrik Olivia, chief executive of the Commercial Farmers Union, says his government is pessimistic at this stage of the deal because there were no significant moves towards compensation by government in the last 16 years.
We are possibly a little bit pessimistic at this stage. Is government sincere? Are they going to move forward with it? But I think this time around, with senior cabinet ministers coming out and saying that government needs to acknowledge compensation needs to be paid to the former white commercial farmers who lost their land, I think this is positive and I think it's a step in the right direction. But we are still very far from settling the matter. It is only talk at this stage, and we need to see some action take place. We need to see the Ministry of Lands, Ministry of Finance, ourselves and all the role players involved get around the table and start deliberating, start debating, start negotiating for what the compensation package should be.
Like Rodriguez, Olivia says the government would struggle to raise funds for compensating the farmers. He says Zimbabwe needs to speed up the process and some aging, destitute former white commercial farmers are struggling to make ends meet because they'd invested everything on their farms.
The biggest challenge would be then, where is government going to get the money from? We know they don't have all the resources. Secondly, is what are the parameters for compensation? Is it only for land, or is it for improvements and land, or only for improvements? Is it based on local market values or regional market values?
The government is planning to introduce some taxes on occupied lands in an attempt to raise money for paying for the seized farms. The farmers hope that the latest moves by the government would finally settle the land disputes, resulting in the revival of the agricultural sector, which once contributed significantly towards Zimbabwe's gross domestic product. Charles Tuff of African Farming Solutions says land can only be fully utilized in the near future if farmers are able to access bank loans using land as collateral.
So when it comes to agriculture specifically, you're never going to get long-term agricultural investment unless you can securitize the land on which you want to invest, because that is your security. So we need to move away from having to have urban assets, as in houses, to develop farms. The farms themselves, through their inherent value, must be able to develop themselves.
The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are pressing Zimbabwe to pay its huge debts, and they have set conditions, including the compensation of white commercial farmers who lost their land before opening new lines of credit for the nation. Zimbabwe passed a law in 1992 which stipulated that only underutilized land would be expropriated, with the government paying compensation for fixed assets on seized white-owned farms. At least 3,500 farmers lost their land under Zimbabwe's controversial land reforms. Reporting for Studio 7 in Shinoi, this is Arthur Chigoriwa.
You're listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington.
We are broadcasting on 909 Metum Wave and on the 4930, 5940 and 15460 shortwave frequencies.
On the internet, find us at www.studio7news.com.
You can also text us at 001-202-465-0318.
Coming up, we'll take a closer look at Gukurahundi atrocities of the 1980s. Stay tuned. First, a look at regional and international news. The European Union is hosting an emergency meeting today in Brussels to try to stave off another terrorist attack as investigators draw links between the 2015 Paris attacks and Tuesday's bombings in Brussels that killed 31 people and injured 300. Muslims are rejecting the call by U.S. Republican presidential candidate Senator Ted Cruz for increased surveillance of Muslim neighborhoods following the bombing of Belgium by suspected followers of the Islamic State. In Cameroon, supporters of President Paul Biya are calling him to move up elections and run again, while opponents say 34 years in power has been more than enough. Investigators today said debris recovered on the beaches of Mozambique is almost certainly from the ill-fated Malaysian Airlines MH370 Boeing 777, which disappeared without a trace after lifting off from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing March 8, 2014, with 239 people, mostly Chinese, on board. And finally, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was convicted today of genocide and nine other charges and sentenced to 40 years in prison. The United International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia found Karadzic guilty for Serb atrocities throughout Bosnia's 1992-1995 war that left 100,000 people dead. You're listening to Studio 7, coming to you live from the Voice of America in Washington. President Robert Mugabe once described the five brigade atrocities in Matabeleland and the Midlands provinces in the 1980s as a moment of madness. In the 1990s, Mr. Mugabe set up an interministerial committee headed by the late Vice President John Nkomo to look into possibilities of bringing closure to the massacres of an estimated 20,000 innocent civilians. The committee never made any recommendations as it was disbanded without a public announcement. Recently, Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa has been strongly defending allegations that he was among top state officials who were involved in the killings, which resulted in the setting up of the Simplicius Chihambakwe Commission of Inquiry to probe the massacres. The report was never made public. Caught up in allegations over the massacres is former Education Minister David Coltart, who recently published a book which alleges that Mnangagwa made disparaging remarks about so-called dissidents and their supporters, mostly aligned to PF ZAPU, then led by the late Vice President Joshua Nkomo. Mnangagwa has threatened to sue Coltart for defaming him. What can Zimbabweans learn from the Five Brigade or Gukurahundi massacres? For perspective, Studio 7's Gibbs Dube reached Reverend Ray Motsi of the Baptist Church, whose PhD thesis was on Five Brigade massacres, and Dr. Shepherd Mpofu of the University of Johannesburg. Motsi says there is a lot that is needed before victims of the massacres can get state compensation.
First and foremost, there must be an acknowledgement of what happened. And this acknowledgement can only come about as people explain what happened to themselves by being given an opportunity to talk. And also there must be people that did this, and we know them, they are still alive, especially the commanding group. The people that were in command, we know they are there. And therefore what we expect to happen is that because these are Zimbabweans, we use Zimbabwean money to do this as government, this must be on the national agenda and it must be addressed as a national issue, because Ndebeles are Zimbabweans like anybody else, and they must be accorded their right to be able to be addressed as Zimbabweans, not as marginalized or people, abandababulayo, people that have just come, they've been somewhere else. To me, once you begin to do that in an inclusive approach, this can actually be dealt with before we start even talking about forgiveness and reconciliation.
Dr. Mpofu, what do you think about this issue?
I think one of the most important things that the Reverend and I agree is about the confession. And all those who are responsible for this have to come out and talk. And one of the most mischievous things that ZANU-PF has always done in regard to Gukurahundi, remember they created the Ministry of National Healing during the GNU period. And what did they do when the Minister of Healing went to Lupane for a tombstone unveiling ceremony? They were arrested. And it seems that was just done to put a blanket over our faces and not to face the real problem. And as the Reverend says, the funding that was used for that project came from state coffers, both the victims and even those who were not affected,
exactly,
people of Zimbabwe. They paid the soldiers' salaries. They paid for everything that was done.
Exactly.
And what we want, firstly, accountability of how the fund, the government coffers were abused. And second,
precisely,
what is it that really happened during that time of the genocide? Because no one knows the truth now.
Mm-hmm.
We have three pieces that explain those things. One, it says it was a Shona versus Ndebele issue. Secondly, it was Mugabe wanted to exterminate Nkomo's supporters. And the third one is there was a super ZAPU funded by the South Africans to destabilize Zimbabwe. And what we need to know now is what really happened. And this genocide has always affected the Shona Ndebele relations in Zimbabwe. And even the National Identity Project that ZANU-PF seeks to create,
that
has always been affected by that. Why is it that Ndebeles are always deputies in leadership, in power, opposition politics, or in government? People will always try to explain those things via Gukurahundi. I was saying earlier on, if children in Matabeleland are to be swallowed by a river trying to cross to school, how do you explain that? Gukurahundi, under development in Matabeleland, how do you explain that? So Gukurahundi has become an auto-explainer to many things that go wrong in Matabeleland. And for you to stop that, you need, as a government, to address those kinds of things and come out clean.
So, Reverend Motsi, at the end of the day, what is the best method of, you know, addressing this issue, you know, when we take into account the role of civil society and so forth? What can be done there?
Yes. There's no need to arrest people that are talking about Gukurahundi. Gukurahundi must be spoken about openly by people of Zimbabwe. That is number one. Number two, we must also grant an opportunity for people who are victims or whose relatives were victimized and died and disappeared to actually talk about this. This whole idea of putting a lid on Gukurahundi continues to traumatize people. And I kind of get a bit annoyed when people keep on talking about reconciliation and forgiveness. What would you be forgiven for when you haven't acknowledged what the problem is?
Yeah.
So to me, this must be a national agenda. This is a Zimbabwean problem. And I will reiterate my point. Shonas and the Ndebeles must come together and address this issue. It's not a tribal issue. It's a national issue. Mm. I'm saying this because I'm Shona. So I'm saying this. I need everybody to know that.
Mm. And what was the starting point, Dr. Mpofu?
And I think Reverend has to also say those who are responsible, those in power, because it's not Shonas who are responsible for this, you know? And some Shonas have been victimized as responsible for this, while they have nothing to do with it. Therefore, those people who are actually responsible, it's either we pressurize them as the people of Zimbabwe, or only when we get a new political dispensation that we can only find redress to this issue. Coming to your question on what should be done, we need, through legal processes, to set up a bill like Jonathan Moyo did. This bill can actually be sponsored by citizens and be pushed through as one other MP or whatever it is. And we need to make it clear that it's time this thing got addressed and those responsible have to come up. And I think if we are to be united as Zimbabweans, we need a system that has political repercussions. It's either we agree together that we're going to vote for a certain party, or we're going to form or sponsor as citizens a certain party that will run with this.
That was Reverend Ray Motsi of the Baptist Church, whose PhD thesis was on the Five Brigade massacres. You also heard from Dr. Shepherd Mpofu of the University of Johannesburg. Studio 7's Gibbs Dube moderated that discussion. MDC Member of Parliament for Mfakose, Porina Mpariwa Gwanyanya, who is part of a delegation of Zimbabwean women in New York attending the annual Commission on the Status of Women conference, says there is an urgent need to align some laws that protect women and girl rights with the country's new constitution. Mpariwa Gwanyanya, who is also the deputy chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Women, says the conference has opened up discussions on strides that have been made in the promotion of gender equality and the empowerment of women globally. Mpariwa Gwanyanya tells Studio 7's Marvelous Mklanga Nyahuye more about the conference, which ends today.
In my experience here is the first time attendee to this particular conference is that there has been some kind of a bond. You can't identify who is coming from which party. And we are led by Honorable Mchanga, who is the chair. I deputize here. I come from MDCT. Then behind my Mchanga, there is Honorable Nyampinga, Honorable Mawoka, and Honorable Mangwende. And on the MDCN side, we have Honorable Twalakale Kumalo Mahlangu. And that's the team that is representing Zimbabwe. We also have got the minister and the commission who are here on behalf of the government of Zimbabwe. And there has been teamwork in terms of attacking issues, attending sessions, delegating each other so that we would get as much coverage of Zimbabwe in every other aspect in terms of the commissions that are running.
So what is your takeaway? What do you think you have learned from this conference that is going to empower women of Zimbabwe, especially those in Mofakose where you represent?
I learned that, Marvelous, water is key. It is a human right. Water has been a problem in Zimbabwe, and we have had the problem in terms of drought where the rain pattern has actually changed, which means the wells are drying, even the taps are drying. Those who had boreholes sunk, sometimes they are dry. I have learned that we need to accelerate actually the digging of wells and the provision of water, including my constituents.
That was Porina Mpariwa Gwanyanya, MDCT Member of Parliament for Mufakose and Deputy Chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Women, speaking with Studio 7's Marvelous Mklanga Nyahuye from New York. So today is Thursday, and of course, for many of you who know, Thursday is Women's Round Table, hosted by Marvelous Mklanga Nyahuye and Praxedes Jeremiah, and that live talk time always 8:30 p.m. And today's topic, of course, what is happening in New York, the conference which brought many Zimbabwean women together. If you wish to join in, please call on 001-202-619-2077. The number again, 001-202-619-2077. And that's all we have for you today. But before we go, quickly, a recap of our top stories today. Some landless white commercial farmers expressed skepticism over Zimbabwe's move to compensate them for seized land. 60 young Zimbabweans have been selected for the prestigious Mandela Washington Fellowship Foundation. And today was World TB Day, which Zimbabwe also commemorated. Leaving you now with Chris Gunde.